All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very special show for you today. I've been thinking about this for more than a month, actually, since September 23rd of this year, because September 23rd is the 90th birthday of John Coltrane, one of the greatest musicians and one of the greatest artists ever to live. Coltrane changed the whole course of music and continues to have a major influence on many, many musicians today in many different forms of music. Now, I'm bringing this to you because I think it's extremely important for people to listen to learn from, and to damn it, to just enjoy. Now, this is an interview that is only available in the Pacifica archives, and I was able to get that, and I wanted to bring it to you. This is an interview that was done by Frank Kofsky in 1966, and it's an interview that really lays out a lot of Coltrane's thinking on many, many different subjects. And as he said in the middle of the interview, he told Kofsky, "I want to be the force which is truly for good." Now, the way this interview developed is that one afternoon in November of 1966, a man named Frank Kofsky took the train out to Long Island. He was about to spend the day with John Coltrane. Kofsky brought his tape recorder, and what we get to hear is the conversation the two men had as they drove through town and made a few stops along the way. Coltrane had moved to Huntington, New York with his wife Alice and their children in 1964. They lived in a modest house on a quiet, tree-lined street. It was a home to raise a family. Coltrane had just turned 40. He would die from liver cancer less than a year later. During this interview, Coltrane talks about moving to the country, setting up to practice, connecting with the sound of an instrument, Malcolm X, music as a means of expressing that state of society, and how he wanted to change the world. So just lean back and let yourself fall into an hour with John Coltrane.
After Chasing the Train came out and then Impressions came out, you did a sort of change of pace. You remember you did the album with Duke and the ballads and the Johnny Harmon album. Whose idea were those albums? Were they yours or were they impulses?
Well, I tell you, I had some trouble at that time. I did a foolish thing. I got dissatisfied with my mouthpiece. And I had some work done on this thing, and instead of making it better, it ruined it. And it really discouraged me, you know, a little bit, because there were certain aspects of that, of playing that certain fast thing that I was reaching for, that I couldn't get, you know, pushed because I damaged this thing. So I just had to curtail it.
Until you got another?
Well, and actually, I never found another, but after so much of just laying around and making these kind of things, I said, well, what the hell, you know? I might as well go ahead and do the best I can. But at that moment, it was so vivid in my mind, the difference in the what I was getting on the horn. It was so vivid in my mind until I couldn't do it, because as soon as I'd do it, I'd hear it, and it just discouraged me, see? But after a year or so passed, well, I'd forgotten.
That's funny because, you know, I think I know your music as thoroughly as any non-musician, and yet that wouldn't have been apparent to me.
Well, that's a funny thing, man. That's one of the mysteries. And to me, as soon as I put that horn in my mouth, I could hear. I could feel it, you know. So I just stopped. I just went into other things.
The reason I asked that was because you recall that was the time you had Eric in and out of the band.
Yeah.
And there was a whole wave of really hostile criticism.
Yeah,
I'm
and
sure
this was all of this was at the same time. So you can see how it was. I needed all the strength I could have at that time.
And
maybe some of these things might have caused me to feel that, well, you know, I said, damn, I can't get what I want out of this mouthpiece, so I'll work on it.
Do you think then this might have undermined your self-confidence to a degree?
It could have.
Why do you think there's been all this hostility to the new music, especially in your case?
Oh, man, I never could figure it out, you know. And I couldn't even venture to answer it. Nah, I just don't know. Because as I told them then, I just felt that they didn't understand.
Do you feel that they were making?
So I feel that they didn't understand.
Do you think that they were making as conscientious and as thorough an attempt to understand as they could have?
At times I didn't feel they were, because I did offer to them, thinking this article and Dombey, and I asked if any of you men were interested in, you know, trying to understand, let's get together and let's talk about it, you know. I felt that they were really genuinely interested or thought there was something here that they, instead of just condemning it, what you don't know about, we want to discuss it, let's talk about it. But no one ever, you know, came for them, so I don't think they were really, they didn't want to know what I had to say about it.
I think it frightened them. Bill.
Well, it might have.
Bill said, you know, we talked about this at great length, and he said, well, these guys, see, it's taken them years to learn how to pick out I Got Rhythm on the piano, and now the new music comes along and undermines their entire career, which is built around understanding based on.
Yeah, it could be, I dug it like that too. I said, well, it could be a real drag to a cat's career if he figures this is something that he won't be able to cope with and he won't be able to write about, you see. And if he can't write about it, he can't make a living at this. And then I realized that, so I quieted down. I wouldn't allow myself to become too hostile back, you know, in return. Although there was a time I kind of froze up on the people at Downbeat. I froze because, I don't know, I felt that that was something that it wasn't. I felt that they were letting their weakness direct their actions, which I didn't feel they should have.
Of course, that makes me want to kill all those people because.
Because
I get so much pleasure out of your music.
Yeah, well, the test was for me. That's who it was for. You know, they could do what they wanted to do. But the thing was for me to remain firm in what I was doing. But that was a funny time, particular period in my life because I went through quite a few changes, you know, like home life, everything, man. I just went through everything I was doing.
The perfect wrong time to hit you.
everything I was doing, you like that.
Yeah.
But it was a hell of a test for me, and coming out of it, it's just like I always said, man, when you go through these crises and like, you come through them, I come out of them, you're definitely strong.
Yeah, if you know, in a great sense,
yeah.
Did the reaction of Impulse to these adverse criticisms have anything to do with those records that we talked about?
The ballads and the... Well, I don't know. I think Impulse was interested in having what they might call a balanced sort of thing, or a diverse sort of a catalog, you know. And I'd find nothing wrong with this myself. You see, I like. In fact, most of the songs I even write now have been written. The ones which I really consider songs are ballads. So there's something there that I mean I really love these things.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And these ballads that came out were definitely ones which I felt at this time, and I chose them. It seemed to be something that was laying around in my mind from my, you know, youth or somewhere that I just had to do. And they came at this time when the confidence in what I was doing on the horn had flagged. It seemed to be just the time to clean that up. And the Johnny Hartman, the man that I had stuck up in my mind somewhere, I just felt something about him, you know, I don't know what it was. And I liked his sound. I thought there was something there I had to hear, you know. So I looked him up and did that other one, see. And I don't regret doing those things at all.
You shouldn't.
No, I don't.
Because Johnny Hartman went with, in my opinion, went with the quartet perfectly. Those are the only six songs I know the words to.
Yeah, me too.
Is there eight? Is it six or eight? Six, right.
I don't regret doing those.
No, no.
But the only thing I regret not having, you know, kept that same attitude, which was, you know, I'm going to do no matter what. Mm-hmm. That was the attitude in the beginning. But as I say, there was a whole lot of reasons why these things didn't happen.
Ups and downs, and I was one of the downs.
Yeah, I was one of the downs.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to a very special interview from the Pacifica Radio Archives. And the interview is done by Frank Kofsky, and it's an interview with John Coltrane.
Do you think that learning how to play the soprano had anything to do with the change in your style from what it had been, say, in 57?
Definitely, yeah.
How so? Could you?
Well, the soprano, by being this small instrument, I found that playing the lowest note on it was like playing the one of the middle notes in the tenor.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, my armature would allow me to make the upper notes.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I would play all over this instrument, you see. And on tenor, I hadn't always played all over it because I was playing certain ideas which would just run in certain ranges, octaves.
Mm-hmm.
But by playing on the soprano and becoming accustomed to playing from that low B flat on up, it soon got so when I went to tenor, I found myself doing the same thing, you see. And this caused the change or the willingness to change and just try to play the, you know, as much of the instrument as possible.
Did it give you a new rhythmic conception, too?
I think so. A new shape came out of this thing, and patterns, you know, the way the patterns would fall.
It seemed to me that after you started playing soprano, and particularly after My Favorite Things, then you started feeling that same kind of a plus on the tenor that hadn't been there in your work before.
In fact, soprano is one of the reasons I started getting dissatisfied with that tenor mouthpiece, see? Because the sound of that soprano was actually so much closer to me in my ear. Or there's something about the presence of that sound, you know, that to me, I didn't want to admit it, but to me it was seen like it was better than the tenor. Or I liked it more, see? And I didn't want to admit this damn thing because I said, well, the tenor is my horn. This is my favorite. But this soprano, maybe it's just the fact that it's a higher instrument. It started pulling my conception, you see. It really was headed going into this instrument.
How do you feel about the two horns now?
Well, the tenor is the power horn, definitely. But soprano, there's still something there. And just the voice of it, it's really beautiful.
Awesome.
I really like. You know?
Do you regard the soprano as an extension of the tenor, or?
Well, at first I did, but I don't know. It's just now it's another voice. It's just another voice.
Do you ever use the two horns on the same piece like you did on Spirituals?
I think that's the only time I've done that. Sometimes in clubs, if I feel good, I might do something like this. Start on one and end on another, you know. But I think that's the only one on record that was like that.
What prompted Farrow to take up the alto? Was that to get away from two tenor sound?
Or I don't know. This
did you talk it over with him?
No, this is something he wanted to do. And at about the same time, I decided I wanted to get one. So we both got it.
I haven't heard you play the alto yet. Do you play it much in...
I played it in Japan. I played it in Frisco a little bit. But I've had a little trouble on with the intonation of it. It's a Japanese make that they... new thing they're trying out. So they gave us these horns to try. And mine has to be adjusted at certain points where they're not quite in tune, so I don't play it. But I like it.
I saw a picture of you with a flute.
Yeah.
Are you playing that too now?
I'm learning.
You're always learning, aren't you?
I hope so. I'm always trying to learn.
I looked at the Downbeat Critics poll 2 years in a row, and this year and last year. Both years I noticed this, that the European critics were much more in favor of the new music than the American. Almost, say, 50% or 60% of them would vote for new musicians,
yeah.
Whereas only, say, about a quarter of the American. Is this what you found in Europe? Is this what you found outside the United States, that your music is more favorably received by the critics, the power structure, shall we say, than in the U.S.?
Well, I'll tell you, in the new music, I believe in that, and when I say new music, I mean most of the younger musicians who are starting out. I know that they definitely have found a quicker reception in Europe than they have here. And when I started, it was a little different because I started through Miles Davis, who was an accepted musician, you see. And they got used to me here in the States. Now, when they first heard me with Miles here, they did not like it.
I remember that.
So, anything, it's just one of those things. Anything that they haven't heard yet, and it's a little different, At first, they're going to reject it at first, man. But the time, it will roll around the time when they will like it. Now, the states, by being here with Miles and running around the country with him, they heard more of me here, and consequently, they began to accept it before they did in Europe, because they hadn't heard me in Europe. But we found when we went to Europe the first time, well, it was a shock to them there, you know, like food, me, and everything in Paris. Because, well, it is, you know, they weren't ready for this. But now I find the last time I was in Europe, it seems that the new music, they're really, you know, they open up, man. They can hear it there better than they do here.
I think that part of this is because what's happening in the new music is analogous to what's happened in painting, say, and sculpture and literature, and the people who appreciate jazz are in Europe are much more aware of this than what do you?
Well, I don't know. I
see, in Europe, jazz is regarded as a serious art, whereas here, it's regarded as well. I don't know.
Whatever
it is, part of the nightclub business, or
yeah.
Otherwise, you couldn't have a magazine like Down Below. Yeah, I know Albert is going back to Europe, and I know that there are many of the younger musicians who want to get away from the States because of that thing. They just don't feel that there's any hope for them here. Do you remember Third Stream Music, what was called Third Stream Music?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel much of an inner urge to play that kind of music?
No.
Why do you think it didn't catch on with the musicians? Is there anything about it that suggests why it was never very popular with them?
Well, I don't know. Well, it was an attempt. It was an attempt to create something, I think, with more of a label, you see, than true evolution.
You mean it didn't evolve naturally out of the desires of the musicians?
I don't think so. Well, maybe it did. I can't say that. It was an attempt to do something, which is, the evolution is about trying to, you know. But there's something in evolution that, man, it just happens when it's ready. You know, although you have to try also. And this just seemed, it wasn't really where it was coming from, you know. It was an attempt to blend, to wed the two musics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this what it really was?
I suppose that's what it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
You said that, talking about saxophone players, that there was a common pool that everybody dipped into. Maybe here there wasn't enough of that pool, for people to dip into.
Well, I just think it wasn't time. It was an attempt to do something at a time when it just wasn't time for this to happen. And therefore, it wasn't lasting. But there may have been some things that came out of this that have been beneficial in promoting the final change, which is coming. See? So nothing is really wasted, although it might, you know, it might appear to fail or not succeeded, you know, the way that the men felt they would have decided to. But
even the mistakes can be instructive if you know how to utilize them.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to a very special interview from the Pacifica Radio Archives. And the interview is done by Frank Kofsky, and it's an interview with John Coltrane.
Do you make any attempt, or do you feel you should make any attempt, to educate your audience in ways that aren't musical? But it's obvious you want your audience to understand what you're doing musically, but do you feel that you want them to understand other things, too, and that you have some kind of responsibility to...
Sure, I try to feel this, and this is one of the things I'm concerned about now. I just don't know how to go about this. I want to find out just how I should do it, you know, and I think it's going to have to be very subtle. I mean, you can't ram philosophies down anybody's throat, and the music is enough, you know, and that's philosophy. But I think the best thing I can do this time is just try to get myself in shape, you know, and know myself. If I can do that, then I'll just play. you see, and leave it at that. And I believe that will do it, you know, if I really can get to myself and really, and then be just as I feel, and I should be, and play it, you see, and I think they'll get it, because music goes a long way, and it really is, it can influence.
That's how I got interested in all those things I was talking about earlier. I mean, in Malcolm X and so forth. I might not have come to it or come to it as fast if it hadn't been for the music, because that was my first introduction to something beyond my own horizons, and it made me think about the world I was living in.
That's what I'm sure, man. I'm sure. I'm really sure of this thing. And as I say, there are things which, as far as spirituality is concerned, which are very important to me at this time, and I've got to grow through certain, you know, phases of this to other understandings and more, you know, consciousness and awareness of just what it is that I'm supposed to, you know, understand about it. And I'm sure all this will be part of the music, which is, to me, you know, I feel I want to be a force for good.
And the music, too.
Everywhere. You know, I want to be a force for real good. In other words, I know that they are bad forces. You know, I know that there are forces out here that bring suffering to others and misery to the world. But I want to be the opposite force. I want to be a force which is truly for good.
That's what so annoyed me about all of that stuff that they were saying about you in 61. And 62.
Oh, that was, well, that was hell. That was really, I couldn't believe it, you know. It just seemed so preposterous. It was so ridiculous, man. That's what bugged me. It was just so absolutely ridiculous, because they made it appear that we didn't even know this, the first thing about music.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing. Yeah. And here we were really trying to, you know, push things on.
Because they never stand still.
No, they never do. And Eric, man, as sweet as this cat was, and the musician as he was, it hurt me, you know.
To see him.
To see him get hurt in this thing, you see.
Do you think that this possibly contributed to the fact that he died so young?
I don't think so. I don't know. But Eric was a strong cat. I don't know. Nobody knows what caused it, what he passed from, so it's a mystery about it. The whole scene, man, he couldn't work. He always seemed to be a very cheerful young man, so I don't think that would push him, you know.
That way?
I don't think so, because he had an outlook towards life which was very, very good, optimistic. He had this sort of a thing of friendliness, you know, to everyone. Real friend, the type of man who could be, he was as much a friend to a guy he just met today as he was the one he'd known for 10 years, you know. So this kind of person like that, I don't think it would really, you know, hurt him to the point where he would do something to hurt himself. Consciously or unconsciously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That friendliness is one of the things that has impressed me about the musicians here. I really didn't expect to be greeted with open arms, because I am an outsider after all. And yet I've been amazed constantly at how eager the musicians were to cooperate once they got the idea that I was sincere, and that this wasn't a joke or a con or something of that nature.
Yeah, well, man, I think that's all that's all we need is sincerity, you know. And word empathy. What is that word?
That's the word, empathy. Means identification with other people. Becoming
what we really are.
Yes,
right?
and being considerate of other people, and not trying to damage them. With treating them, in other words, with the same care that we would want to be treated ourselves.
Absolutely.
Do you live far outside of wherever we are now?
Well, I guess I'm about 4 or 5 miles down the road.
You really sound like Farmer John.
Yeah, man, when I come up here and I have to get everything I'm going to get, you know.
That's right, because you...
I got to go to the store and do all that, because I don't want to come back up here. Yeah, well, I've gone through this. I don't know. I think I want to get closer to town, because, I don't know. Maybe there's something I can do in music, you know. Maybe I can get a place, a little room or something to play in.
Everybody else has those lofts down in Cooper.
Yeah.
But I would, you know, I mean, that's not really suitable for you anymore. It's okay. It's one thing when you're in your 20s, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want a loft, but I don't know. Maybe there's something I can get to play in. There's some place to be able to work, you know. I'll give somebody some work in.
Where do you play at home? I heard you practicing over the phone. At least I thought that was what I heard.
Yeah, well... Anywhere, there's a room over the garage out there that I'm getting fixed now. I think it's going to be my practice room. You know, sometimes you build a room and it ends up, you ain't still going to toilet, so I don't know. I hope I like it. But I was in the living room, and I just, anyway. I keep a horn on the piano, and I have a horn in my bedroom. My flute's usually back there, because when I go there, I'm tired, so I lay down and practice.
About how many hours a day do you play, would you say?
Not too much at this time. I find that it's only when something is trying to come through, you know, that I really practice, and then I don't know how many hours, you know, it's just all day.
Until on and off,
yeah. But at this time, it's nothing is coming out now. It's just I'm kind of taking in.
I was very surprised to hear you practicing at all, because... Yeah. I just couldn't conceive of what you could find to practice,
yeah,
but I know it isn't like that.
I need to practice, man. It's just that I want something to practice, and I'm trying to
find
out what it is that I want, the area that I, you know, want to get into.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to an interview done by Frank Kofsky with John Coltrane. That's right, the amazing John Coltrane. And this is an interview that was conducted with Coltrane just a year before he died of liver cancer. And the interview can be found in the Pacifica archives. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned for more of John Coltrane. Welcome back. That was Blue Train from John Coltrane. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is a special interview taken from the Pacifica Archives. It's an interview that was done by Frank Kofsky with John Coltrane in 1966, just 1 year before the amazing Coltrane died of liver cancer. So let's get back into the interview now.
The people I was staying with have a friend, a young lady, and she was at downtown at one of Malcolm X's addresses, speeches, and lo and behold, who should plop down in the seat next to her but John Coltrane?
Yeah.
So right away, that whetted my curiosity, and I wanted to know how many times you had seen him and what you thought of him when you saw him and so forth.
That was the only time.
Were you impressed with him?
Definitely. Well, that was the only time. I felt I had to see the man, you know, and I was living downtown. I was in the hotel, saw the posters and realized that he was going to be over there. So I just said, well, I'm going over there, you know, and see this kid, because I'd never seen him. I was quite impressed.
That was one of his last speeches, wasn't it? I mean,
it was towards the end of his career.
Some musicians have said that there's a relationship between some of Malcolm's ideas and the music, especially the new music. Do you think there's anything in that?
Well, I think that music, being an expression of the human heart or of the human, of the being itself, does express just what is happening. I feel that it expresses the whole thing, the whole of a human experience at any particular time that is being expressed.
What do you think about the phrase, the new black music, as a description of some of the newer styles in jazz?
Well, phrases, I don't know, they don't mean much to me, you know, and it's just because usually I don't make the phrases, so
that's right.
I mean, I don't react so much to them. I mean, it makes no difference to me one way or another what it's called.
If you did make the phrases, could you think of one?
I don't know what the hell, I don't think I have a phrase. I don't think there's a phrase for it, you see, I could make.
The people who use that phrase argue that jazz is particularly closely related to the black community, and it's an expression of what's happening there. That's why I asked you about your reaction.
Well, I think it's up to the individual. You can call it what you may, for any reason you may. Myself, I recognize the artist, and I recognize an individual. I see his contribution, and when I know a man's sound, well, to me, that's him. You know, that's this man. And that's what I recognize. I mean, I don't like labels. I don't bother with it.
But it does seem to be a fact that most of the changes in the music, the innovations, have come from black musicians.
I would agree with you.
Have you ever noticed, since you've played all over the United States and in all kinds of circumstances, have you ever noticed that the reaction of an audience varies or changes if it's a black audience or a white audience or a mixed audience?
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Any examples?
It's hard to say, man. You know, sometimes people like it or don't like it, no matter what color it is.
You don't have any preferences yourself about what kind of an audience you play for?
Well, to me, it doesn't matter. I only hope that whoever's out there listening, I hope they're enjoying it. That's the, you know, if they're not enjoying it, I'd rather not be there.
If people do enjoy the music, how would you like them to demonstrate this? Do you like an audience that's perfectly still and unresponsive, or do you like an audience that reacts more visibly to the music?
I guess I like an audience that does show its, you know, what they feel, or respond.
I remember sometimes when you played the jazz workshop in San Francisco, you really got that kind of an audience that you didn't get when you played Shelley's Manhole in Los Angeles, and it seemed to me that had some effect on the music that you played.
Yeah, because it seems to me that the audience, in listening, there is an act of participation going on there, you know, and when you know that somebody is maybe moved the same way that you are to such degree, or approaching the degree, it's just like having another member in the group.
Is that what happened at the Ascension date? People who were there, did they get that involved?
I don't know. I was so doggone busy.
Yeah.
I mean, I was worried to death. That was my, you know, that was the way I felt. I couldn't really enjoy the date if it hadn't been a date, then I would have really enjoyed it. But the date, I'm trying to get the, you know, time and everything set, and I was just too busy myself. But I don't know. I hope they felt something, you know, what they felt this. To hear the record, I mean, I enjoyed all of the individual contributions.
It's a beautiful
on
record.
That.
Probably the one record that I've had to listen to the most number of times to get,
you know,
down to everything that's happening.
Yeah, we got another take out on it now.
What do you think then about playing concerts? Does that seem to inhibit the interaction between yourself, your group, and the audience?
Well, on concerts, the only thing that bugs me on concerts might be halls or poor acoustics, which we can't quite get the unit sound, you see. But as far as the audience, it's about the same. I don't understand.
I wasn't too impressed with the acoustics in Friday night's concert.
No, I wasn't either.
I was sitting right down front, so I could hear most of what was going on, but even then it didn't sound...
I couldn't feel it.
You can tell the musicians, they can't hear each other, and therefore they can't get themselves together.
It's like the wind, you're from the wind.
Yeah. Another reason I asked you about Malcolm was because, you know, I've interviewed about a dozen and a half musicians by this time, and the consensus seems to be that especially the younger musicians, talk about the kind of political and social issues that Malcolm talk about when they're with each other. And some of them say that they try and express this in the music. Do you find that in your own groups or in the musicians you're friendly with, that these issues are important to you and you do talk about them?
Oh, well, they're definitely important. And as I said, the issues are part of what is, you know, at this time. So naturally, as musicians, we express whatever it is.
Do you make a conscious attempt to express these things, or do you feel that it just...
Well, I tell you, myself, I make a conscious attempt. I think I could say, truthfully, that in music, I make, or I have tried to make, consciously, an attempt to change what I found in music, you see. In other words, I've tried to say, well, this, I feel, could be better, you see, in my opinion. So I will try to do this to make it better.
Yeah,
and this is what I feel that we feel in any situation that we find in our lives. When there's something that we feel should be better, we must exert effort to try to make it better.
And
so it's the same socially, musically, politically, in any department of your life.
Most of the musicians I have talked to are very concerned with changing the society, and they do see their music as an instrument by which society
can
be changed.
Well, I think so. I think music is an instrument. It can create the initial, just the better thought patterns. It can create the change, you see, in the thinking of the people.
In particular, some musicians have said that jazz is opposed to poverty and to suffering and to oppression. And therefore jazz is opposed to what the United States is doing in Vietnam. Do you have any comments on that subject?
On the Vietnam and
well, you can divide it into two parts.
Oh, let's see.
The first part was whether you think jazz is opposed to poverty and suffering and oppression. And the second part is whether you think, if so, jazz is therefore opposed to the United States' involvement in Vietnam.
Well, in my opinion, I would say yes, because I believe that, in my opinion of jazz, as we call it now, we talk about that later.
Okay, well, call it what you want.
Yeah, call it what you want. To me, it is music, and this music is an expression of, to me, higher ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, brotherhood is there. And I believe with brotherhood, there would be no poverty. And also, with brotherhood, there would be no war.
That also seems to be what most of the musicians feel. David Isenson, for example, said that almost the same thing when I talked with him Monday. He said, well, what we're saying in our music is that we want a classless society without these frictions and without the waste and without the warfare. Would you care to comment on working conditions for, quote, jazz musicians? Do you think that jazz artists are treated as they deserve to be treated, and if not, can you see any reasons why they wouldn't be?
Well, I don't know. It's according to the individual. You find many times a man may feel that the situation is all right with him, where another man may say, well, that situation is no good for you. So it's a matter of a man knowing himself just what he wants. And that way, it's according to his values. You see, if he doesn't mind a certain sort of treatment, then I'm sure he can get it, so he can find it somewhere. If he does mind it, then he doesn't have to put up with it. In my opinion, at this stage of the game, where I'm at now, I don't care too much for playing clubs consistently. Now, there was a time when this felt all right to me, because my music, I felt I had to play a lot to work it out, you see. But now I don't think that was absolutely where it was at, but I had to find it out myself. Yeah, I had to go through this thing, you know. Well, and now I don't feel this is necessary. I think that it is a matter of being able to be at home and to go into yourself, you know, more. In other words, like the years before I was playing, you know, every night. And as such, I don't feel the situation involving the club is not an ideal one for me now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to an interview done by Frank Kofsky with John Coltrane. That's right, the amazing John Coltrane. And this is an interview that was conducted with Coltrane just a year before he died of liver cancer. And the interview can be found in the Pacifica archives.
What is it about the clubs that you don't like?
Well, actually, excuse me. We don't play this set 40-minute kind of thing anymore, you see, and it's very difficult to always do this kind of thing now. And the music are changing as it is. A lot of times when it's, it doesn't make sense, man, to have somebody drop a glass or, you know, somebody ask for some money right in the middle of Jimmy Garrison's solo.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I know exactly
what's happening in there, you see? And these kind of things that are calling for some other kind of presentation, I think.
In other words, these really are artists who are playing, and yet they're not really being treated like artists. They're being treated like part of the cash register.
Well,
they're just there to bring up the money.
Yeah, I think the music is rising, and my estimation is rising into something else. And so we'll have to find this kind of place to be played at.
Why do you think conditions have been so bad for producing art by musicians? What do you think causes these poor conditions that you've spoken of?
Well, I don't really know how it came about, because I do know there was one time when a musician played more dances, and he used to play theaters and all this. Well, this took away one element, but still it was hard work these guys had to do. Because I remember some of those one-nighters, though, pretty difficult, But it just seems that the music has just been directed by businessmen, I would suppose, who know how to arrange the making of a dollar and so forth. Maybe often the artist hasn't really taken the time himself to just figure out just what he's... Or if he does feel it should be presented some other way, And I think these are the things which are being thought about more now.
That's what I find, too. Do you think the fact that almost all of the original jazz musicians were black men and have continued to be throughout the generations, do you think this encouraged the businessmen to take advantage of them and to treat their art sort of with this contempt, bringing up the cash register in the middle of a bass solo?
Well, I don't know.
Most of the owners, I noticed, are white. And,
this could be, Frank. This could be. I don't know.
How do you think conditions are going to be improved for the musicians?
Well, there has to be a lot of self-help, I believe. And have to work out, their own problems.
You mean
in this area.
Like, for example, the Jazz Composers Guild was trying to do by...
Yeah, I do think that was a good idea. I really do.
Yeah,
I don't think it's dead. I mean, it was just something that couldn't be born at that time, but I still think it's a good idea.
This is the history of all kinds of organizations in this country, is that they're not always successful the first time, but I think it's inevitable that musicians are going to try and organize and protect themselves against... For example, I was at the Five Spot Monday night, and I figured that there are about 100 tables in there, and two people at a table comes to about $7.50 a set, at three drinks a set. And that means he's making $750, say, a set, and he has five sets. And I know that musicians for that night aren't getting anywhere near five times $750, or even two times $750. So actually, it turns out that these businessmen are not only damaging the art, but they're even keeping people away.
Yeah, it's putting them up tight, a lot of people, man. I feel so bad sometimes about people coming to the club. I can't play long enough for them because,
the guy is hustling you
on. Hustling me on, and they come to hear you play, and you get up, you have to play a little bit and split.
Yeah, if it hadn't been...
These things, something has to be done about it.
If it hadn't been for Elvin taking, the bartender aside, I couldn't have stayed there because I ran out of money after a set. Do the musicians who play in these newer styles look to Africa and Asia for some of their musical inspiration?
I think so. I think they look all over.
Do they look some places more than others?
And inside.
I heard you, for example, talking about making a trip to Africa to gather musical sources. Was that the idea?
Well, I intend to make a trip to Africa together, whatever I can find, and particularly musical sources.
Do you think that musicians are more interested in Africa and Asia than in Europe, as far as their music goes?
Well, the musicians have been exposed to Europe, you see. So it is the other parts that they haven't been exposed to, which I think they're trying to at least I speak for myself, mm-hmm. I'm trying to have a rounded UC education.
Is that the significance of those rhythmic instruments that you've incorporated into your group to give it a sort of Middle Eastern or African effect?
Well, if so, or maybe so, but it's just something I feel.
Why do you think that the interest in Africa and Asia is growing at this particular time?
Well, it's just time for this to come about, that's all. It's just a thing of this time.
Bill Dixon suggested it might have something to do with the fact that many African nations became independent in the 1950s and changed the way the Negroes in this country looked at themselves, made them more aware of the African heritage and made them more interested in going back and looking for it. Do you think there's anything to that line of thought?
Yeah, it's part of it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to an interview done by Frank Kofsky with John Coltrane. That's right, the amazing John Coltrane. And this is an interview that was conducted with Coltrane just a year before he died of liver cancer. And the interview can be found in the Pacifica archives.
Another question along the same lines is, it seems that group improvisation is growing in importance. For example, what you did with Pharaoh when you were both playing simultaneously, and also, of course, Ascension. Do you think that this is a new trend now? Or not a new trend, but do you think that this is growing in importance now, this playing?
Well, maybe. I don't know. It seems to be happening. I don't know how long it's going to stay.
Why do you think that's taking place now?
I don't know why. It just is. That's all I can tell.
But it is there. I mean, I'm not making something up when I'm
talking. No, I feel it. It's there, but I don't know why.
And another question about the new music. I've noticed that a lot of the new groups are pianoless, or even in your case where you have a piano, sometimes you'll have the piano layout during a solo or parts of a solo. Why is this coming about at this particular time? Why the desire to de-emphasize the piano? Or rather, not to de-emphasize it, but to give it another kind of position in the group, another kind of role?
Oh, I don't know, because, see, I still use the piano, and I haven't reached a point where I feel that I don't need this phone. I don't know. Maybe it's because, when you're not playing on a given progression, you don't really need anybody there to state these things. And if it would get in your way to have somebody going in another direction, you trying to go in this, then it'd be better for you not to have the piano.
It seems that some of the direction that the horns are going in, too, is to get away from the 12-tone scale, to play notes that really aren't on the piano. The really, you know, the high-pitched notes, the shrieks and screams. I don't know what words you used to describe those words, but I think you know what I mean. The sounds that were considered wrong, well, still are considered wrong by some people. If you play those notes that really aren't on the piano, and you have the piano there stating notes that are on the piano, do you feel that this is some kind of a clash that you'd rather avoid in the group?
I suppose that's the way some men feel about it. As I say, I still use the piano, so I haven't reached this point yet where the piano is a drag to me, you know, to that degree. I don't, we don't follow what the piano does anymore because we all move in our own direction.
You do have...
I like it for a backdrop, you know, of the sound.
You do have the piano, though, lay out a fairly large part of it.
Well, after a while, I always instruct the piano players that whenever they wish, they can just lay out and let it go on as it is. Because after a while, lots of times, the pianos, well, they get tired. you can't think of anything else to play. Just stroll.
When I talked to you a couple of years ago in Los Angeles, and I asked you if you ever would consider adding another horn to your group, you said... Probably the thing you would do is, if you added anything, you'd add drums. did you have in mind then these kinds of things that...
I don't even know, man, but I guess so. And that's just, I still feel so strongly about drums. I really do.
You said you were listening to African music, and you noticed that if you played that with some of your music, that it still all sounded right, because anything you played over the drums...
Yeah, I feel very strong about these drums, but it's just like I experimented in it, but we didn't have too much success. I believe it would have worked, but, Elvin and McCoy, they couldn't hold it. It was time for them to go.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be two drums. It could be just drums and another rhythm instrument. That's what I was really referring to, not the
Elvin. Yeah, I think so, too. Now I'm thinking they could come in different forms, shapes, I just don't know how to do it.
After all, the things that you were playing up there Friday night, those are rhythm instruments too. Not all rhythm instruments are
good. Oh, that's true.
That's what I meant when I said if you, that's what you had in mind.
Yeah.
Speaking of Alvin and McCoy, it reminds me of something Sun Ra said, and I'll repeat it. I'll make it clear that I don't put any faith in him, but since he said it and he told me to tell you, I thought I'd pass it along. He says that you hired Rashid as a means of driving Alvin and McCoy out of the band because you didn't want them in the band in the first place, and that was your way of doing it. Do you want to answer that? Or?
No, I don't. So I was trying to do something. The thing I wanted to do in music, see, and I figured I could do two things. I could have a band that played like the way we used to play, and a band that was going in the direction that the one I have now is going. I could combine these two with these two concepts going, and it could have been that.
Sun Ra is quite bitter and claims that you've stolen all of your ideas from him, and in fact that everybody has stolen all of their ideas from him, which is rather exaggerated.
There may be something to some truth to it. I've heard him, and I know that he's done some things that I've wanted to do.
How do you feel about having another horn in the group now, another saxophone? Do you feel that that in any way competes with you, or that it enhances what?
Well, it helps me stay alive sometimes, because I find that physically, man, the pace I've been leading has been so hard.
I never have seen
that. Sometimes I've just been a little, you know, and I've gained so much weight, you know, fact that sometimes I've been a little hard physically. And I feel as I like to have somebody there in case I just can't get that strength. I like to have the strength in that band or someone. And Farrell is a very strong spirit and will, and these are the things I like to have up there.
Well, strength is the word. It's the word for the band now. I mean, strength and energy.
I like to have this energy.
Do you feel that spurs you on, the presence of, especially a man as powerful as Farrell?
Yeah, all the time. There's always got to be somebody with a lot of power. Because Elvin, in the old band, Elvin had this power.
Mm-hmm.
I always had to have somebody there with it, yeah. Rashid has it, but it hasn't quite unfolded completely, you know. But it's all he needs to do is play.
Yeah, that was my impression, too, that he really was feeling his way ahead in the music.
Oh, yes, and didn't have the confidence that Elvin had.
But then, of course, Elvin, look how long Elvin was with you before
Elvin was there for a couple of years, although Elvin was ready from the first time I heard Elvin, you know, he was, I could hear the genius there. But he had to really play. You had to start playing steadily, and every night or however you're going to play, you have to keep building, and it comes out. It's like it was miles. It took me around 2.5 years, I think, for it to start developing, you know, like it was going to take the shape that it was going to take.
That's what's so tragic about the situation of the younger musicians now, is they don't have that opportunity to play together.
Yeah, it certainly needs to be done. It should be happening all the time. And the men would develop sooner.
Don Cherry has a new record out, and I think it's a beautiful record on Blue Note, and one of the reasons I think it's so good is because here he has a group that's worked together for a few months.
Yeah.
And so he knows how to put something together for all of the men that isn't just
a date.
I know you are, because, you know, you kept the group alive that way.
Yeah, I sure tried to.
Have you listened to many of the other younger saxophonists besides Farrell?
Yes, Albert Ayler first.
Could you see any relationship between what you were doing and what he was doing? In other words, do you think that he had developed out of some of your ideas?
I don't, not necessarily. I think what he's doing is, it seems to be moving music into even higher frequency, you see.
To me, it appears that some of the things that you did,
like maybe where I left off, maybe where he started or something.
In a sense, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Not
to say that he, you know, would copy this or that, but it's just that, you know, he filled an area that it seemed that I hadn't gotten to.
It seems like,
in a sense,
that to me, it appeared that your solo on Chasing the Train, that he had developed some of the ideas that you put out there, and he had expressed them in his own way, but that this was one of the points from which he had begun. Had you ever thought of it in that light?
No.
Do you ever listen to that record much?
Only when at the time that it came out, I used to listen to it and wonder what happened to me.
What do you mean?
Well, it was a sort of surprising thing to hear this back, you see, because, I don't know, it came back another way.
How did it come back? Did
it? Well, it was a little longer than I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a fairly good amount of intensity in it, you know, which I hadn't quite gotten into recording before, you see.
You were pleased with it?
You know, to a degree. I mean, not that I could sit there with it and, you know, love it forever.
Well, I know you'd never be pleased with anything you did for longer than a week.
I realized that I'd have to do that or better, you see.
I think it's a remarkable record, and I also think you ought to go back and listen to it.
Maybe so.
Because I see a lot of the younger... Well, I don't see any saxophonist now who isn't playing something that you have at least sketched out before.
No,
Archie, seems to me, is the one who's gone furthest in the direction of his own style. But if you listen to Archie 3 or 4 years ago with Cecil Taylor, he was playing those up-and-down triad things that, you know, that are really one of your trademarks. But maybe you'd rather not think about that.
No, well, you know, because, like, it's a big reservoir, man, that we all dip out of. So, you know, and I... Like, you know, a lot of times you'll find that a lot of those things, I'd listen to John Gilmore kind of closely before I made Chasing the Train, too. So some of those things on there are really direct influences of listening to this cat, you see. But then I don't know who he'd been listening to, so it's
right. So it is a reservoir, yeah.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to thank the Pacifica Archives for actually maintaining and making this interview with John Coltrane available. And hopefully it's giving you something to think about, both what a giant John Coltrane was and what his music meant to the people of the world. John Coltrane, who would have been 90 years old on September 23rd of this year. All right, I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Russian Lullaby from John Coltrane. Talk to you again next week. Thank you.